And welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. That was Dave Lippman and the Urgent Ensemble. Dave is a topical singer. Probably heard him on free radio before. This song and this album I'm going to be playing cuts from will be about, well, it's about 21 years old. So it's early 80s. What with all the obnoxious Reagan nostalgia that we're going through for the last week, seems appropriate. And I think it's something I'm going to be playing. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the twice-weekly show concerned with a variety of topics, a lot of them my personal idiosyncrasies, but generally kind of zeroing in on civil rights for the poor in Santa Cruz. I take a lot of phone calls here at 427-3772, if you want to call in. Email rnorse@hotmail.com. And before I give you even more introduction, let's take this call. Maybe we'll actually have a caller who wants to talk on the air. Hi, you're on free radio with Robert.
Oh, hey, Robert. I'm listening on the computer. I was just wondering if it's the same thing as what's on the radio.
The computer is usually a little slower than the radio. You're probably getting the last refrain of Dave Lippman's song.
Okay, yeah. Is a DJ on there?
Let's see.
Because I never listened before. I can't get it in the radio.
Are you trying www.freakradio.org?
.net.
.org.
Oh, it's .org?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try. Thanks.
Fair enough. Bye-bye. Yeah. www.freakradio.org is, I think that's the right. Let me double-check my own business cards here to make sure that I'm actually not misdirecting all of you to the wrong place. Yeah, it's .org, not .net. So, you can call in, you can email in, you can listen in. If you want to send in some money or some kind of equipment or some kind of pledge, you can reach us on the web at that address, www.freakradio.org. You can send in to the snail mail address, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And if you want to be a programmer on this show or you have off-air information you want to give, so you don't want to be put onto the air immediately, which I often do, you can call for radio business 427-4523, 427-4523. That's Free Radio's voicemail line. If you've got a public service announcement, say you want to pass on to the station, which other broadcasters can replay at a later time, or if you have information for the station or commentary that you don't necessarily want to give out live, or if you want to talk to somebody about a particular issue that you want to reach because you like that particular broadcaster, 427-4523. If you want to reach me off air, boy, it's number time, phone number time, all right, you can reach me on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, Huff, the group that I work with, and the phone number is 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. But right now, the number to consider calling if you have anything you want to talk about after hearing what I've had to say, or maybe, you know, if you've heard past shows, you want to bring up new issues, 427-FRSC, 427-3772 is the number to call. So, it's going to be a lot of, we don't have an actual guest for today that's planned, although we may actually have Joy may be coming in to do a demo for her show. Joy is a sometime homeless person who's now in Santa Cruz, who's a woman who's seeking a show here on Free Radio. She's going to use a little bit of my hour to give the Central Committee here a notion of what they will be getting and what the community will be getting on her show. I'm not sure if she's going to show up today, but she may. We had a taste of her, I think it was last week, and we've interviewed her on the air before, and she heard some positive things, some feedback, and that was great. Thank you, Joy, for coming in. Again, if you have an interest yourself in a show, the number to call is 427-4523. There are slots still open, and, you know, you might be the one to fill them. Think about it. Let's hear another number from Dave Lippman while I clear my throat and take a swig of water, and then we'll get into some more of the news of the day. And I'm going to be playing some tapes from the biotech conference, not so much what was said inside. They locked us out of the conference, but some of the protest on the streets that I and my erstwhile producer Becky Johnson ran into last Tuesday when we went up there and sniffed around. So stay with us. It sounds a bit like dead air. Let's see what the problem is here. Aha! I can do. Reach the end of the tape. Stay with us.
Singing treason, but in a land of plunder, and always there's a reason. What's the average song on the radio? Is it a love song, or is it just lust? I tell you my motto, treason or bust. Anybody can get ahead, but I don't wanna get anywhere if it means more peasants get shot dead. Who's the biggest criminal in history? Was it Hitler?
Or was it Cortez?
Or was it maybe
John D. Rockefeller?
Do better, some countries do worse. My country's the last on the list, but they say they're the first. Hey now, what's the biggest single crime in history? Was it Nagasaki?
Oh, was it Wounded Knee?
Oh, was it maybe
World War III?
That's Dave Lippmann. So, we will be getting actually a guest coming in shortly. He just called in during that song. You can call in, 427-3772. He's going to be talking about some subjects near and dear to his heart, namely why protest isn't working, and gosh, who knows what else he's going to be talking about. He's talked on the air before. He's a lively spirit, and you can join the chatter. Usually I don't get to my notes, so I'm going to start with my notes today and just sort of run through a few of them. First of all, I want to let you know, and as I want to remind you that I told you on Thursday, that Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper, is out. The new June Street Spirit should be available on the streets from a vendor of your choice. Often you can find vendors near McDonald's on Ocean Street. Sometimes vendors venture downtown to Pacific Avenue, though perhaps not so much as they used to. And if you really want a copy of Street Spirit, you should be able to find one at the Homeless Resource Center, or Homeless Service Center, that's out at 115 Coral Street, where It's called The Shelter, but it's not really a shelter. It is a day center, and it's a transit point for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, where up to about 40 homeless people can get access to space on the floor, which means actually nobody can because it's always filled. 40 people do, but the rest of the 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people who are in the city limits area estimated every night don't have any access to even proposed floor space, much less, you know, civilized accommodations. But out there you can get a copy of Street Spirit, the monthly homeless paper. You'll find articles about Santa Cruz. There's one about Kennedy and the liberal hypocrisy on the city council. If you go by the Huff Table, which is also a source for civil rights for homeless distribution point literature, we have a Huff Table every Wednesday and Thursday evenings, usually 6 to 9 on Wednesdays, 6 to 8 on Thursdays, a little longer actually, but that general period, and that's around the New Leaf Market Borders area. It's New Leaf on Wednesday, and it's on front of Borders on Thursday. You can get the same articles, or more of them, actually, and see what my perspective is and that of other writers locally who are trying to cover subjects that the Sentinel, the Metro, the Good Times, KSCO, the media don't cover. And we try to... You can also go online while you're at it if you want to follow some of these resources, and you can get access to the Huff website, which we're actually beginning to start working on. That's www.huffsantacruz, all one word, small letters, Huff Santa Cruz, H-U-F-F Santa Cruz, all one word, all small letters, .org. And there's a variety of stuff. Most of it is older stuff, but I think it's historically interesting, and a lot of it is still very relevant. And there's also access to the Huff blog, or where you can actually read ongoing discussions. The website was redesigned after, I guess, it crashed a couple months back. It's still in the process of being redesigned. But you can get access to it. If you have trouble, you can give a call at the Huff line, 423-HUFF, and I'll try to assist you or put you in touch with those who can assist you better, since my computer literacy is notorious, or illiteracy, actually. Anyway, Street Spirit is available. It's also available from producer Becky Johnson, whose phone number is in the book. She's the only Becky Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, if you want to get a copy directly from her. Or if you're homeless and you want to sell it, and you can do that for free, I say we don't charge you for it. You can take some papers, go out and sell them for a buck or more a piece, whatever you can get for, and then use it for, you know, weapons of mass destruction, shooting heroin, all the vicious things that homeless people do. Just kidding, folks. You can sell for what, but you get your money, and you get to use, you know, get a small pittance, so you can actually buy a cup of coffee every now and then, or, you know, a spare tampon, that sort of thing. If anybody was at the conference yesterday, the Housing Trust Conference. It was at the Loudoun Nelson Center. Paul Brindell and other local service providers or social service bureaucrats is a harsh word, but I think it's probably an accurate word, who are there. If they want to report in on what happened, I'd love to hear about that. In fact, I may do a little sniffing around to see if I can get a report. I know former Homeless Issues Task Force Chair Linda LeMaster may have made her way there, though I'm not sure about that. And we may try to get her on the air to talk about it, bushwhacker, so to speak. So that's another subject I'm going to be hoping to cover. There's an article on the internet about, I guess I got an email from, I think it's from Oregon, where Ralph Nader is holding a nominating convention. For those of you who are Nader fans, I want to zip up there by hook or by crook. He's going to be placing his name in a nominating convention on the ballot for president Saturday, June 26th, so that's 2 weeks, at Benson High School Auditorium in Portland. And he was on the ballot in 43 states in 2000, expects to be on the ballot in more states this year. He will speak about the Iraqi War, or the Iraq War. Local activists, we should call it the U.S. War against Iraq, local activists and community groups are being invited to table at the event, recruit new members, and distribute literature. This pattern was used successfully during the Nader super rallies of 2000-2003. Nader breathes new life into community groups wherever he goes, as said Jason Kafuri, National Field Coordinator for the Nader Campaign, and that's up in Portland. You may be wondering why I'm reading this, since we're some distance away. Kind of keeping you abreast of what's happening. I think he failed to make the Oregon ballot, he's trying to get the... He failed to be nominated by one of the third parties, so now he's throwing a nominating convention of his own. 1,000 registered Oregon voters need to attend before the convention will be empowered to place Nader on the Oregon ballot. An attempt to place Nader on the ballot by convention in April fell short by more than 200 votes. Last time, Ralph's schedule was bringing him to town, so we decided to try to do a quick effort to pull a convention together, get him on the ballot. Many people assumed it would be easy to gather 1,000 people, so they did not feel their attendance was necessary. Our organizational efforts in April were inadequate, and we had to live with their knowledge that we embarrassed Mr. Nader. We will not make the same mistake again. Everyone will know how important it is that they be there for Ralph. Bush's policy in Iraq has created a military quagmire and a political and moral disaster, said Jason Kafuri. When John Kerry is asked how his policy would differ from George Bush, he gives us no answer. If we are to debate the Iraqi war this November, the man who will force the debate is Ralph Nader. And that's according to from an email from Jason Kafuri at jkafuri, F-O-U-R-Y, at votenader.org. If you want to get back to him and talk to him more about that. I'm, not a wholly fanatic Nader supporter. In fact, I don't really support his position on the Iraqi war. I don't think it goes far enough. He talks about phased withdrawal and setting a date and so forth. I think an immediate withdrawal is what's called for, fast. And you turn it over to Iraqis to deal with. You've had a year to prepare that kind of stuff, How many more decades do you want? Shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's U.S. presence creates more problems than it solves, to make the mildest statement possible, not to mention we're engaging in an aggressive war that has already killed thousands and thousands of people and is probably encouraging tens of thousands of people who would be sympathetic to what Bush likes to call terrorists, what some would say are people who want us out of the Middle East, not playing a dominant military role over there. So that's happening there. There's a kind of encouraging news, some might say, from this recent poll. Here's a story from The Guardian, June 12th. Most American voters believe it was not worth going to war in Iraq, and almost two-thirds believe the U.S. is getting bogged down, according to a Los Angeles Times poll. The poll, which shows the views on the Iraq war represent a divide between Republicans and Democrats, reveals that 53% of the voters say the situation in Iraq did not merit the war, while 43% say it did. When the question was asked by the same pollsters in November and March, the figures were reversed. Meanwhile, only 35% believe the U.S. is making good progress, while 61% feel America is getting bogged down. Conducted on the weekend that saw the final details of the unanimous U.N. Security Council vote to endorse the June 30th takeover, the polling results are grim news for President George Bush. Results from the same poll on Thursday showed his Democratic Party challenger, Kerry, extending his national lead over the president, although Mr. Bush was faring better in swing states. Among those who think the threat from Iraq justified war, Mr. Bush leads Mr. Kerry, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, 83% to 13%. Among those who think the war was not justified, Kerry leads Bush, 84% to 11%. Three-fifths said Mr. Bush's Iraq policies had hurt America's image abroad. One in five thought they had improved attitudes toward the U.S. But if the survey revealed that Mr. Bush was in trouble, it was not all good news for Kerry, with whom many voters have yet to positively identify. In a sign, Kerry's position is murky to many voters. The poll found 15% said he'd offered a clear plan on how to handle the situation, while 34% said he had not, and the rest did not know. We'll have a musical break, and then we'll continue. If you want to call in, 427-3772 is the number.
And we found the man for you and me. Deutschland is happy and gay. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Rhineland's a fine land once more. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Watch out, Europe, we're going on tour. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
It's springtime.
Winter for Poland and Germans, go into your dance.
I was born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Myself, heil to me. I'm the Kraut who's out to change our history. Heil myself, raise your hand. There's no greater dictator in the land. Everything I do for you. If you're looking for a war, here's World War II. Heil myself, raise your beer. Every Hotsy-Totsy Nazi stand and cheer.
Every Hotsy-Totsy Nazi.
Hail myself.
Every Hotsy-Totsy Nazi.
Hail myself.
Every Hotsy-Totsy Nazi.
Stand and cheer.
The Fuhrer is causing the Fuhrer. He's got those Russians on the run. You gotta love that keep hot. The Fuhrer. Causing a furor. They can't say no to his demands. They're freaking out in foreign lands. He's got the whole world in his hands. The furor is causing a furor.
Got a phone call from the Reichstag, told me I was Fuhrer. Germany was blue. Oh, what a what to do. Hitched up my pants and conquered France. Now Deutschland's smiling through.
But it wasn't always so easy. It was 1932. Hindenburg was working the big room, and I was playing the lounge. And then I got my big break. Somebody burned down the Reichstag. And would you believe it? They made me chancellor. Chancellor! It ain't no mystery if it's politics or history. The thing you gotta know is everything is showbiz. I myself watch my show. The German Ethel Merman, don't you know? We are crossing borders. The New World Order is here. Make a great big smile. Everyone's big heil to me. Wonderful me.
Springtime for Hitler from the musical version of The Producers, a longer version of the song. You may have heard it way back at the end of the 60s in the Mel Brooks movie. It's now out in longer form in the musical, which unfortunately is not on film yet or on video, as far as I know, but who knows? Any day now, or if you happen to be wandering through New York City, you can always check it out. I guess, I'm not even sure if it's playing there, but anyway, it's a cool musical. And it's a very contemporary song, as I'm afraid too many of us realize. More about the Los Angeles poll. I've been able to pull it up on the computer under the LA Times. You can do that too. Just Google for the LA Times. You have to register, but you can get in there. There's a longer version of it, but even the Mercury News' edition of the discussion of the poll, which is headlined, "Poll: Most Voters Say Iraq War Wasn't Justified." There's some depressing news for some of us. Most U.S. voters, though they say it was not worth going to war in Iraq, an overwhelming majority still reject the idea of setting a deadline to withdraw all U.S. forces from the country, though they found that the voters are increasingly worried that the U.S. is becoming ensnared in Iraq and pessimistic that a democratic government will take root there. Fewer than one in five said the U.S. should withdraw all its forces within weeks. I'm a part of that group. At least I'm one in five. I think I was one in 5,000 before. Who knows? Or at least maybe not. Maybe there were more of us. Fewer than one in four endorsed the idea of advanced by some Democratic Party-leaning foreign policy experts and liberal groups to establish a specific date for withdrawal. In perhaps the most emphatic measure of anxiety about Iraq, 53%, as mentioned before, said they did not believe the situation there merited the war. 43% said it did. And the Times poll asked that question, of course, before. The numbers were reversed. And that's some of the additional information that kind of, to me, is really relevant. How many people actually are calling for a sane U.S. policy? And again, we're talking about a poll that's probably slanted to begin with. It's probably a phone poll. Let me double-check here. I'm trying to find the mechanics of the poll. I got the results here. Maybe you'll have the mechanics as I scroll down. Most voters retained faith that the U.S. could control the military situation in the country. About half of those polled, 52%, said they thought the U.S. was winning the war. 24% said the insurgents were winning. At least they're aware there is a war, and that's good. In the studio with me, by the way, we have a guest who I'm been encouraged to comment on the poll here, which I'm reading from, the LA Times poll. Looks like he's brought his own documentation with him. I will encourage my guest to sign in using whatever moniker he wants.
Hi, this is Ray, downtown hair guy.
It's Hair Man Ray. He'll pull your hair, but in the nicest way, I'm told. So, welcome to the studio, Ray. Have you been hearing this, or have you just sort of...
No, actually, I just walked down, so I'm not really up on what you've been talking about for the last few minutes.
Okay.
Nice new studio. Looks great.
Isn't it beautiful? It's great. In our secret location. I'm showing Ray the San Francisco San Jose Mercury News version of the LA Times poll. A couple more findings in the poll. 35% said the U.S. were making good progress. 61% said the U.S. was getting bogged down. Majority of the Republicans see progress occurring. And, of course, there are figures about how 53% said the situation did not merit war. 43% said it did, starting at the, you know, there's not really, a majority believes that the U.S. should not have gone to war in Iraq. But again, only 1 in 5 thinks we should pull out now, within weeks at least, and only 1 in 4 believes that there should be a definite date set. So for those of us who are trying to get a little sanity in the situation, to inject a little common sense, compassion, humanity, and just, I don't know, even if you're a conservative Republican, you should understand that why would you want to spend, I guess it's wealth redistribution to the large companies that have contracts in Iraq, the large American companies. But it's certainly not really going to be power redistribution to the U.S. I don't think it's a tenable situation. Ray, as our foreign policy analyst, what's your view?
Well, you know, first I always say that, you know, when I look in the newspaper and I see these things about polls, I don't read this because this is crap. This is the same kind of crap that they base elections on. And, you know, and I don't know who they poll. They've never, ever asked me what I think, and that's why I'm here and using this venue. And pretty much, if they say 53% of whatever, what does that really mean? 50%, how many people out there in this audience have been polled? How many people out here has anybody ever come to you and asked you what you think about the war? Now, the interesting thing that I will say about this on a positive note is that, okay, you know, we've been at war now for over a year, and the war actually started, you know, closer to 2-3 years ago. And, you know, for a lot of us who have been against this, who have seen the writing on the walls and have been telling our friends, telling everybody that would listen, that this is wrong and that this is going to blow up in our face, well, at least, you know, it's finally starting to happen. But even so, they're doing everything that they can to whitewater it down and to skew it, you know. Don't you think, Robert?
Yeah. I do. And, of course, the war started long before that. I mean, they've been killing, 1.5 million people in Iraq are dead because of U.S. sanctions via the U.N., 500,000 of them children, according to, I believe, the U.N.'s own estimates.
Yeah, I would say that the war started with Ronnie Reagan.
U.S. was funding, Reagan funded the Iraqis, so in a way, I mean, and then, you know, got them the research in the Iraq-Iran war, and then you have Bush encouraging Iraq to invade Kuwait, and he invades Kuwait, and then suddenly, wham, bam, he's there and, at war with Iraq. And then you have the sanctions throughout the Bush and Clinton years, and then you have, well, hey, the whole sad story is there. If you want to say a word about it, perhaps scream a little about it, now's the time, 427-3772, if you'd like. Though that's not often, that's not really the main focus of the show, but that's okay. I mean, I often want to read specific commentary on it, and I don't get to it, so that's good. Go ahead.
One of the other things I wanted to say was, there was a picture in the paper, I don't know if anybody caught it a few days ago, of a police attack dog down in Watsonville. And I have this picture, I'll show it to you, Robert, but I mean, the look on the guy's face who is using this dog, I mean, and this isn't a drug-smelling dog, this isn't a bomb-sniffing dog, this is a dog that's going to be unleashed against the public, that's you and me. And when you look at this picture, you also I also have another picture next to it of a Army soldier doing the same thing with an attack dog in Iraq. And, you know, they say that this war was built on the moral high ground to, you know, relieve tyranny from the Middle East, and you know, it's not. It is a lie. And tell me what you think of the picture, Robert.
Opened your scrapbook here. And there's a German Shepherd dog being kind of choked back by a rather burly character in, I don't even call those wraparound sunglasses, a burly police officer.
Big grin on his face.
Watsonville police officer Lance Stackhouse works with police dog Zinc Tuesday during the canine clinic to perfect the animal's law enforcement behavior. Law enforcement behavior. I wonder if that's what they call it in Abu Ghraib. And then we see, you showed me a picture of another dog menacing an Iraqi prisoner.
At Abu Ghraib.
At Abu Ghraib, yeah. Or Grob. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. But in any case, it's interesting. More information came out yesterday. And I guess the Washington Times got a report. I'm not sure if I have it here that I can immediately pull it up. About specifically one of the things which our head of Homeland Security refused to say in testimony before the Senate on Thursday, I think it was he was asked by Kennedy, it wasn't asked by Kennedy, he was asked by Biden and some other senator whether he would release the memos that essentially justified torture 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, that were drawn up for the administration. And those memos included codicils and appendixes which gave specific details as to what kinds of torture were considered appropriate and who should be approached. And that he wouldn't give those documents, but the documents are out. The documents came out. I read them in a story yesterday, as I ate dinner. I'm still looking for the paper, but it's either the Saturday Chronicle or the Saturday Mercury News. It, you know, gives you the story as to the specifics, I want to get it on the air. In fact, I'm going to find it. It comes out of the Washington Post, and I will have it later in the show. You know, what do you say but scream loudly into the mic and, you know, or vomit? I don't know. It's, what do you think, Ray? What's the answer?
Well, you know, again, you know, the torture thing, you know, the Geneva Conventions, you know, obviously state that any kind of torture is completely wrong. And, you know, it's just like the Constitution. It's just like any contract. You know, the people who have the money, the people who have the power will use, by definition, these words and these papers to their, you know, to their, you know, to their own agenda. And for me, or for you, Robert, to try and stand on the Constitution or try to be protected by the Geneva Convention, you know, it's a laugh. It's not going to happen. You know, I used to be a constitutionalist, but the older I get, the more I realize that that isn't even good enough anymore. So we have to come up with something completely different, or we have to all perish under the Constitution that will be used to, you know, to cloak the abuses with.
Here's a story from the Sunday Washington Post. I think there's even more details than the ones I read yesterday, but it's headlined, Use of Dogs at Iraqi Prison Was Authorized. U.S. intelligence personnel ordered military dog handlers to use unmuzzled dogs to intimidate detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The Washington Post reported on Friday, citing sworn statements from handlers provided to military investigators. A military intelligence interrogator also told investigators that two dog handlers at the prison were having a contest to see how many detainees they could make involuntarily urinate out of fear of the dogs, the Post said, citing statements obtained by a newspaper. Six U.S. soldiers face possible courts-martial, and one has already been jailed for a year because of the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison, where photographs have shown detainees being sexually humiliated, physically tormented, and threatened with dogs. Two Army dog handlers assigned to Abu Ghraib, Sergeant Michael Smith and Sergeant Santos Cardona, told investigators that military intelligence personnel asked them to bring their dogs to prison interrogation sites numerous times to help question detainees in December and January, Washington Post reported. According to the report, Smith and Cardona said they complied with the request because they believed the tactics had been approved by the prison Reuters. Been approved by Colonel Thomas Pappas, military intelligence officer in charge of the prison, according to Reuters News Service. I'm going to try to get the longer version of this story.
Yeah, but I say whatever. You know, as a one-time American soldier, as a ranger, I would consider that an unlawful order, period.
It's interesting that I guess some did but were afraid to challenge it. Maybe some had fun with it at the time or did so reluctantly and took a lot of pictures and of it. I guess they've now banned video cameras and, you know, various kinds of cameras in these bases.
Not only have they banned the cameras within the bases, but I read a story where Rumsfeld basically said that, you know, American soldiers, cameras aren't part of your gear. He doesn't want to see any cameras in Iraq, Afghanistan, or anywhere else for that matter.
And here's a story. Sanchez approved torture in prison. The top U.S. military officer in Iraq approved letting officials at Baghdad jail, this is Washington Post, subject detainees to temperature extremes, reverse sleep patterns, and diets of bread and water whenever they wished, the Washington Post reported on Saturday. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez borrowed heavily from a list of high-pressure tactics used at the U.S. detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, when he granted wide latitude to officers overseeing detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison, the Post reported, citing newly obtained documents. General Sanchez approved letting senior officers at Abu Ghraib, quote, use military dogs, temperature extremes, reverse sleep patterns, sensory deprivation, and diets of bread and water on detainees whenever they wished, according to, I guess they're repeating the same story twice. The documents spell out in greater detail than previously known the interrogation tactics Sanchez authorized in early September 2003 and made it clear for the first time that before last October, these tactics could be imposed without seeking the approval of anyone outside the prison. Unnamed officials at the Florida headquarters of the U.S. Central Command, which has overall military responsibility for Iraq, objected to some of the 32 interrogation tactics Sanchez had approved. By October 2004, I guess they mean 2003, those measures were ended and prison officials were to obtain Sanchez's direct approval to use the remaining authorized pressure tactics, the Post reported. Sanchez will be replaced by a four-star general, possibly General George Casey, vice chief of the staff of the Army when the transitional Iraqi government takes office on June 30th, senior Pentagon officials said in late May. Pentagon officials said that earlier that Sanchez's failure would likely be on hold, future would likely be on hold, until the investigations are completed, emphasizing it was not a matter of punishment, but of command accountability.
Interesting. You know, I was reading a book not too long ago. It was about the Gestapo, and it had lots of pictures, and it had lots of documentation of the techniques that they used to interrogate the resistance. And go figure, they used dogs. Go figure, they hooded people, they did sleep deprivation, they trussed people up in, you know, different positions to cause them to go out of consciousness, back into consciousness, out of consciousness, back into consciousness. Basically the same thing. And, you know, to me, it seems like it all came over with Operation Paperclip, you know, and we've become the Nazi fascists.
Operation Paperclip, you remind us, is...
Yeah, that is when the United States, at the end of World War II, and Russia divided up the spoils of war being Nazi scientists. Half of them went to Russia, half of them came over here. I actually met one of them a few years ago. And these are the people that started our, you know, our psychological warfare operations. These are the people who designed rockets for us, biological warfare. I mean, those Nazi scientists right now, they'd be spinning in their grave with envy at the things that we are able to do in this country under the guise of democracy.
Well, again, looking at articles on torture, here's an article from The Guardian, A Torturer's Charter, from June 12th by Richard Norton Taylor. On the stage of a London theater on Thursday night, a lawyer held up an official U.S. document classified by Donald Rumsfeld as secret and not for foreign eyes. Considering its contents, the document has attracted remarkably little attention here since it was leaked this week to the U.S. media. Its significance was raised by Clive Stafford Smith, director of the U.S.-based group Justice in Exile, at the end of a performance of Guantanamo, the Tricycle Theater's moving indictment of how the U.S. rounded up detainees, or, quote, unlawful combatants, as it calls them, and sent them to the U.S. base in Cuba. Stafford Smith is acting for some of the Guantanamo prisoners, challenging the conditions in which they are being held. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to give its ruling before the end of this month, Rumsfeld's classified document drawn up by U.S. government lawyers bears directly on the case. It argues that American interrogators can ignore U.S. domestic law banning torture because it would restrict the president's powers in his war on terror. The document drawn up last year says that, quote, criminal statutes are not read as infringing on the president's ultimate authority over, quote, the conduct of war. It adds, quote, in order to respect the president's inherent constitutional authority to manage a military campaign, the prohibition of torture must be construed as inapplicable to interrogators undertaken pursuant to his commander-in-chief authority. Constitutionally, America's... This is the Guardian writing again. Constitutionally, America's founding fathers entrusted the president with the primary responsibility and therefore the power to ensure the security of the U.S. in situations, quote, of grave and unforeseen emergencies. The document goes on, numerous presidents have ordered the capture, detention, and questioning of enemy combatants during virtually every major conflict in the nation's history, including recent conflicts in Korea, Vietnam, and the Persian Gulf. And it continues, Congress can no more interfere with the president's conduct or the interrogation of enemy combatants than it can dictate strategy or tactical decisions on the battlefield. the lengths to which Rumsfeld's lawyers are prepared to go to protect the freedom of the president's agents and place them above the law are reflected in other passages. The document states that U.S. interrogators can use harsh measures as long as they were not, quote, specifically intended, unquote, to inflict, quote, severe mental pain or suffering. In another passage, it says that, quote, even if an interrogator knows that severe pain will result from his actions, if causing harm is not his objective, he lacks requisite specific intent. Interrogators can appeal to the defense of necessity. In other words, they can argue that torturing individuals is needed to prevent greater harm or... namely, that domestic law does not apply to actions inside the U.S. Torture can be committed inside the U.S. The Pentagon's lawyers describe Guantanamo Bay as, quote, included within the definition of the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the U.S. and accordingly is within the U.S. They add, thus the torture statute does not apply to the conduct of U.S. personnel at Guantanamo Bay. The apparent non sequitur is based on the argument that the statute is confined to actions outside the U.S. In other words, the torture is not banned within the U.S. So the anti-torture law only refers to things that happen outside the U.S. according to this argument that is being used in the document that Rumsfeld either had prepared or was addressed to him. Yet this directly contradicts claims made by other U.S. government lawyers who insist Guantanamo Bay detainees have no rights under U.S. law. The naval base, they insist, is not sovereign U.S. territory, so the detainees do not have such basic rights as access to a fair trial. The issue is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. If the detainees win this argument, it could lead the way to at least some kind of judicial process, including the testing of evidence. But whatever Guantanamo Bay's territorial status, according to Rumsfeld document, detainees there and anywhere can be tortured at will in Bush's global war on terrorism. That's even if the Supreme Court agrees that they are in the U.S. The authorization I issued was that anything we did would conform to U.S. laws and would be consistent with international treaty obligations, Bush said this week. Little comfort there. That's Richard Norton Taylor writing in the London Guardian. He's their security affairs editor.
You know, Robert, what a mouthful. I mean, and what great spin. You know, are we at war? Has Congress declared war? Or is this just our wartime president on his little, you know, vindictive thing against the guy who threatened his daddy?
Well, Congress, Kerry among them, voted to authorize the funding for this war, and I guess they gave him some sort of mandate in November. And they still haven't taken away the mandate. You still see the same hacks on both sides. They're kind of vying for power, like wolves howling at who's going to get the, you know, the raw meat first. But neither of them is proposing that this war be ended.
Have you been following the draft?
I have been aware that all the draft boards have been reconstituted, and that it's simply awaiting some congressional authorization. Actually, may be making its way through Congress now.
Right? Yeah, it's making its way through Congress right now, but most people don't know that because, like, all last week, all we saw was Ronnie Reagan's flag-draped coffin.
Well, maybe I should do a little scrolling around on the Internet to talk about the draft, too. Maybe what I should do also is kind of break this up with a little tape. We have here some... interviews and commentary from San Francisco on Tuesday. How much time have you got here, Ray?
I got plenty of time.
Why don't we play a little of that, and then we can get back to more babble. You're talking to Ray, or you're not talking to Ray and Robert on the air. You could be. 427-3772. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org. So, hey, stay tuned, or call in, or both.
So it is June 8th, 2004. I'm in San Francisco with Becky Johnson, and we're approaching the Moscone Center at 4th and Folsom Streets, where before we'd noticed police lines, quite a collection of cops a block up, and you've got your occasional police officer or two chatting different places around the Moscone Center. There's a conference on biotechnology. Is that the deal, Becky?
Well, it's like the genetically modified organisms, gene splicing, and Frankenfood.
Indeed.
Yum yum.
See, there's an eyewitness news van parked here in the 76 gas parking lot. And again, pairs of officers at different points along the block in front of the Moscone Center. I'm inconspicuously wearing my international terrorist t-shirt, the picture of my hero, George Bush, on it. And it's a sunny but windy afternoon. Lots of folks walking around with placards on, badges around their necks in laminated plastic. No collections of protesters, though, that I can see. Some news media popping out of the occasional vehicle parked in a tow-away zone. It's 3 to 7 p.m. tow-away zones on San Francisco streets. Looks like at least one live... Yeah, they're not going to be towed away. In fact, there's a police van parked here, too, and looks like three media vehicles for different media stations. Not sure which ones those are. Here at 4th and Howard, this is Howard, there are a lot of police barricades up, although they aren't barricading anybody. There's it says SFPD, police line, do not cross, and these sort of metal barriers about 3 feet high, and they're ringing the sides of the street. Crosswalks are open. He's my favorite.
I like Hitler.
Well, yeah, but he's gone. We got stick with a new generation. And I. We have a man with a picket sign here. It says, biotechnology industry making poor farmers even poorer. You want to tell us about this for Free Radio Santa Cruz?
Sure. I'm a farmer from Humboldt County. I'm come here representing not only myself, but farmers from around the world, many of whom are way too poor to go to another state within their own country, let alone come all the way here to America to protest the biotech industry, which is basically changing world agriculture. World agriculture is brought out by peasant farmers, typically grow the most food for the people. They've been doing it for thousands and thousands of years. They know how to do it. And the big subsidies from the United States corporations allows food to be transferred to these countries through the IMF and World Bank, and so the poor people of those countries have become dependent on the U.S. food supply, and they can't grow food as cheaply as they can get it.
What's going on here today?
Going on here today is a biotech conference in which, you know, people are doing business deals and just trying to increase the amount of the biotech industry in that's happening, and it's also, you know, probably setting, you know, some sort of future for, you know, trying to save the world through biotechnology, which
now are you have a sign that I read it before, biotech making poor farmers even poorer. This is addressed to the delegates and to the community both?
Yeah, it's addressed for everyone. People aren't aware. In the country of India a few years ago, the mustard seed crop, which they grew for oil, was contaminated with diesel oil. All of a sudden, some soybean oil showed up, and some soybeans, genetically engineered soybeans, for the people to plant to replace their mustard seed crop. Well, these people didn't grow soy, and soy didn't really like to grow on their land, and so a lot of it failed. 25,000 people, 25,000 peasant farmers that year committed suicide in India because of this. This is why I'm here.
Have you had any conversations? I see the delegates coming and going here. from Moscone West and then going across the street. The sidewalks are, at least three-quarters of the sidewalk, or maybe half, three-quarters blocked off by barricades, and you have about, you have a police escort of about 20 police officers here. Are you that much of a terrorist threat?
No, no, I'm definitely not that much of a terrorist threat. And I have a, more so yesterday, a lot more delegates were coming up and talking to me out here. Today, it's probably, they're told probably not to talk to the protesters and are warned about them. I'm not sure, but I'm speculating that things like that have happened.
Well, too much information could be bad.
Yeah.
So, where are there other protesters, or are you the lone protester?
Yeah, I have a friend across the street over there from, looks like he might be from another planet over there.
Oh, right, yeah, the alien. I noticed him as I was driving up.
So he might be a good person to talk to about the pharmaceutical stuff that's going on and about cancers and things like that.
Have you seen much in the way, how are the police treating you?
Well, I think because our numbers were low, the police were fairly good. They did pepper spray some of our protesters early in the morning, and I did see a couple of arrests where they really were beating on people. And
here at 4th and Howard?
Right here, but they haven't been totally intimidating and pushing people out. They did violate our First Amendment rights, as they usually do, by kicking people out of areas and not letting them be where they want to be.
So. Well, I noticed much of the sidewalk has been walled off.
I could not stand here on the sidewalk early this morning. They wouldn't let anyone in this area at all. So.
I see. So you are permitted on the sidewalk, I guess, mainly because you're alone and there's no other protesters here?
Yeah, if there were other protesters around, there's no way they'd be letting me stand here.
Have you, you say that you had a better response from the delegates yesterday. Have you, what happens when you appeal to delegates? I noticed you were appealing before we started. You want to try appealing now and see what they say? Or?
I don't know. I just try to speak to them, to say, hey, you know, this is, you're stealing the food supply of people who can neither read or write. Peasant farmers farming 2 or 3 acres of land, which their families have been doing for centuries, that they've known how to grow their own food. You're taking one food and saying, you can't grow this, you need to grow soy. It doesn't work. So.
That's actually what.
But usually I'll wait for someone to come up and talk to me about things like you know, try to explain to me, you know, how this, you know, why is it that, you know, genetically engineering is making poor farmers even poorer.
Uh-huh.
And I will tell them the story, you know. It's basically farmers save seed, and especially peasant farmers, they've been doing it for years. They don't go buy seed at the store. They plant what they've grown. And with genetic engineering, you can't do that. The seed is patented. So the seed's only good when you buy it. You can't replant it. So.
What topics are on the agenda indoors today? I noticed a sign outside says, well, it talks about the Bio 2004, entry restricted to Bio 2004 attendees only. Credentials must be displayed at all times. Had this been originally the intention of the folks throwing this, or was there a change because of the number of protesters who showed up?
Oh, well, I mean, these signs were obviously made a while ago. But they knew protesters were going to be around, and it's, you know, it's part of the fear mongering that this society brings on to people. We're nonviolent protesters. We're not going to hurt anybody. We might yell, try to have dialogue with people, but there's no way we're going to hurt these people. And so, of course, it's overkill by the police, and they, you know, they don't want to let dialogue happen between us.
Well, I don't think Officer Fabrini will object if certain people want to talk to us.
Well, no, but they wouldn't let us go into the conference to have dialogue.
How are you doing?
So.
It doesn't seem that they're too eager to talk to folks on the street. But there's always a possibility.
A few people are
here. And Officer Brady stops a member of the public trying to walk through, and she directs her to go around.
Yeah, they've made this whole intersection confusing.
Around the barricades.
Oh, okay.
And people, of course, are docilely accepting this kind of direction to go here, there, and everywhere. One wonders when people will say, whoa, wait a minute, isn't this public space?
You know, it's funny this morning, you know, a lot of smell of a goat's art used to being treated, and the police would say, no, you have to go around this way, and they'd be like, no. A lot of them were following rules, but some of them were objecting to being herded around when it's very simple. They could have just walked straight across.
We have people from different places. Here's a man from the United Kingdom who's passing by.
A lot of European people here.
And looks like we got somebody from... Where are you from, sir? What country are you from? And here's a Royal Veterinary College man that came over. Looks like folks... I don't know, how many people are at this convention, would you estimate?
I think there's around 20,000 delegates or something that are here, you know, representing their countries and, you know, trying to sell their products and make business deals here.
So this is primarily a commercial venture or a scientific one?
Well, from what I've read, it's really, there's no science in there. It's almost all commercial. I haven't been in myself, though. That's just what I've read.
Uh-huh. Well, you should obviously, you know, get yourself a badge, and then you could march in with a sign, presumably. Or would they stop an individual with a badge carrying a sign?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sure they would stop me and not let me in.
Well,
see
if you
had
a badge, you know, show your badge.
If you had a badge, yeah, you could probably get in with a sign, but I don't. So. They probably have an outlaw against signs as well, so.
Well, I don't see any delegates carrying signs.
But I know there are people in here that are, you know, that are protesting. I think that's just probably one of the rules, is that you can't have a sign within the convention. So
you want to say who you are for free radio?
Sure. My name's Pelosi, and I'm a small organic farmer up in Humboldt County.
And you came all the way down from Humboldt for this particular protest?
Yes, I did.
What kind of things do you farm?
I'm a vegetable farmer, corn, beans, peas, carrots, squash, tomatoes, melons. My big crop, staple crop, is garbanzo beans.
And is that, you actually make a living doing that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I make a living.
You haven't been sued yet for genetically engineered theft of garbanzo beans, or?
No, but last year my neighbor was asking me what he thought about if he was to grow genetically engineered corn in the field right next to mine. And I was like, no, you can't do that. It would pretty much, I wouldn't be able to sell my corn if that was the case.
And how long is the conference going to go on? We're here on Tuesday.
I think it's tomorrow's the last day. So
this is it. Well, any final words for Free Radio Santa Cruz and the folks down the peninsula?
I just want to thank you for being there, and I love free speech, and just thanks for all your support. We fill it up in Humboldt County.
And thank you again. We've been talking with
Paul Osi.
Thanks, Paul.
Anyway, good luck. I'm glad you're on here.
And that, of course, was from the biotech conference, or I should say outside on the sidewalk, or on the side of the sidewalk, since the police had cut the sidewalk in half, or actually into one quarter and three quarters, giving three quarters of it was behind barricades that only the delegates could use. And the delegates, there were about, as you said, 10, as he was saying, 10 to 20,000 of them, folks in business suits, almost all of them with badges around their necks, many of them from Europe. So I was actually kind of curious to ask them what they thought of the war, and what they, because they came from a different venue, even if they may be, you know, supporters of biotechnology or involved in that genetic engineering, but wonder how they felt about foreign policy. Actually talked to a few of them, and there were a few interviews later on. I want to, at this point, apologize to Christopher Robin, who may be listening on his computer. Hope you were able to do that, Christopher. I am still trying to scavenge your tape. It's somewhere here, but I haven't found it yet. He did some interviews and boiled them down for me, and I was going to play them on Thursday, and I was unable to by time constraints. Now it looks like by who knows what other kinds of constraints. I'm not able to find them today, but hopefully I will. In the studio with me is Hairman Ray. Ray, you've been listening to this protest in San Francisco, though actually when we got up there, there was only a literal handful of protesters. Like, I think we went into five or six. And most of them were in singles at different places on the sidewalk. We missed the earlier morning scene where there was pepper spraying, arrests, people getting under the wheels of a bus, and so forth. What do you think of such protests? You showed me a photo of you dodging a cop on a horse from February of 2003, I presume, with a big protest against the war in Iraq. a month before they began the bombing and invasion.
Yeah, that's right, Robert. You know, back in February, you know, the cops did crack down hard, but there were so many people out there that, you know, I mean, you know, they really had to wait for their moment, and they chose their moments carefully. And the picture in the paper of me, you know, I actually got thumped by that particular cop, and I got pictures of him hitting me. All I was doing was photographing the event, and I ended up with a bruise about 6 inches by 4 inches across my back from his, he had one of those ninja sword sticks on his horseback, you know, just a real sick individual. And anyway, so, you know, I went to...
Surely you mean a police baton, standard issuing equipment for any officer. Have you filed a claim against the city of San Francisco?
No, I don't have any energy to give them in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't mean anything to me. I heal quickly. And but I thought about this a lot, and through those 4 days of where pretty much, you know, the people overran the city in many different ways, you know, it was a great thing. You know, I consider myself an ethical anarchist, and I live that life. And, you know, I also believe that sometimes, you know, direct action, you know, you need to take direct action. And I'm one of those people who will throw a brick through a bank window when I get the chance. But, you know, a year has gone by, and I've done a lot of thinking about this, and I've been watching all the protests that have been taking place in this country. You got a phone call? And I've been, you know, I've been thinking about the strategy of protests, and, you know, I feel that at this time and stage of the game that it's no longer working. I mean, if we show up, then all that happens is that justifies a crackdown from a militarized police state. And what happens is, you know, fewer and fewer people show up because more and more people are actually getting, you know, brutalized and ending up in jail. So people are like, you know, they're leery to show up. You know, I still want to show up because I enjoy it. But I also think that it's being used against us. I was reading a article not too long ago, and actually it's this month's current issue of Vanity Fair. It was about the insurgency in Iraq. And what I took away from that article was this one thing. The Iraqi insurgents, would rather call them guerrilla fighters, you know, realized real quick that to take on American troops in a pitched running battle with rifles and RPGs, they're going to lose every time because they're outgunned. So they realize that, you know, why shoot at them? Because all they'll do is they'll kill us, and they'll destroy our neighborhoods, and they'll kill lots of innocent folks. So thus they came up with the improvised explosive device. This is the mine on the side of the road that's taking down a lot of our soldiers. And when you think about it, the beauty in this is that, you know, once the smoke clears, there's nobody for the soldiers to shoot. You know, of course, it does create an atmosphere where the soldiers will want to go in, grab people up, and torture them and try and make them say, you know, who made this device, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, the soldiers are running scared. You could see it on their faces in the pictures. You could see it by their fingers are almost always on the trigger, even if they're just standing around talking to an Iraqi. I mean, they trust nobody over there. Now, I think we need to come up with something like that here in the United States. Improvised explosive device. Now, I'm not talking about blowing anything up. I wouldn't say that. But what I do think is that we need to do something that's covert. We need to do something on a guerrilla scale. And, you know, I like to think, you know, instead of, you know, showing up for a protest, because all that's going to do is put money in those cops' pockets, overtime, that, you know, and they love to beat us down. So instead of doing like that, we need to realize the bigger, you know, the bigger scope of the matter. And that always brings me back to the dollar bill. You know, the dollar bill with the pyramid on the back, the one that says the New World Order. You know, I think what we need to do is really concentrate on where we spend these dollar bills and what we do to get these dollar bills. You know, I see the government as a machine, and like all machines, it needs fuel, and the fuel is dollar bills, it's taxes, it's people who vote, it's people who take part in the system. If you take all that energy that you give the system, whether it's by voting or paying taxes or, you know, even protesting and doing that kind of stuff, and take all that energy and put it into your own self, into your own community, come up with something that is creative, and pull all of your money out of their banks, take all of your money, give it to your friends in your circle, in your co-ops, whatever you can come up with, this is a way that we can take energy away from the machine, and eventually the machine will grind to a halt. But we have to prepare for that, just like the Iraqi guerrillas are preparing for a long-term engagement. What do you think about that, Robert?
I'm sympathetic with a lot of what you're saying. It's hard for an old geezer like myself to give up on protest and, you know, linking hands in front of... I mean, I'm for example, preparing a sign that says, U.S. out of Iraq now, honk yes for once for yes, twice for no. I'm going to carry it where I go and listen to how the cars respond, just to get some kind of... encourage other people to get involved. I think that we need more creative forms of protest. And many have been proposed, ranging from boycotts to banner drops on the freeway, which we saw, I guess, last week. Tree sits, all kinds of different, you know, different things have been proposed. I mean, I think you got to find a variety of tactics. I think, but you're making kind of a broader critique. You're suggesting that we really need to stop devoting our energy to circumstances that essentially legitimize more militarization of the police, because that is their tactic. After the Seattle protests were relatively successful, they went forward and they're flooding the area with police, and they're essentially suspending the Constitution in areas where there threatens to be large protests in order to preempt any kind of protest. So I don't know. I mean, it's a provocative idea what you suggest. It sounds.
Well, you know, all of what you said, you know, I said, as an anarchist, I mean, I love showing up, and I will show up, and, you know, if the time is right, I will throw the brick. But also, it's not just what you do, you know, overtly like that. It's also how you live your life. I mean, if you are using your credit cards to buy gas for your car to go up to San Francisco to protest, and then you're further using your credit cards and your ATM cards to buy food and stuff when you're up there, this is not helping.
And indeed, I do that when I go up to San Francisco, so I'm personally culpable. any callers who might have thoughts on this are encouraged to call in at 427-3772. We're talking to that fiery Uncle Ray here from the streets, who's actually part of our local community. He dresses up here. Mm-hmm. I know when you called me this morning, you also had another subject in mind, which I'm going to introduce, if you don't mind, kind of by moving on to that.
Oh, yeah, totally.
By reading this article from the San Jose Mercury News on Friday called "Like Offenses Net Different Penalty, Manslaughter Cases Debated" by David L. Beck, Mercury News. Last summer, Nora Maher, a 72-year-old grandmother from Costa Mesa vacationing in the Bay Area with her family, died when Timothy Baldwin, 46, hit their van with his sports utility vehicle on Highway 1. Baldwin admitted being under the influence of prescription drugs. Last fall, Pascal Bramasco, 44, a homeless man pushing a shopping cart filled with cans and bottles along a dark two-lane road in Watsonville, died when Arturo Villalobos, 48, hit him with his handicap-accessible van and drove away. When tested 2 hours later, Villalobos had a blood alcohol reading of 0.18. Baldwin got 7 years in prison after pleading guilty to gross vehicular manslaughter while intoxicated and other charges. Villalobos was convicted of vehicular manslaughter and leaving the scene, but unlike Baldwin, he won't go to prison. When Villalobos' sentencing hearing resumes Monday, and that's tomorrow, folks, in Santa Cruz County Superior Court, Judge Samuel Stevens is expected to sentence him to probation with electronic monitoring. Villalobos' driver's license will be suspended, quote, for a number of years, according to his attorney, Robin Foss, but not permanently. Why the difference between the Baldwin and the Villalobos sentences? Judge Stevens' detractors say it is because Baldwin's victim has had a family and Villalobos was homeless. Prosecutor Gordon Isen argued in court Thursday that social status should not be a factor, and the judge countered that it wasn't. The primary consideration in Villalobos' case, Foss said, is that he provides a lot of care for his daughter, who not only has spina bifida, but also all of these secondary impairments. Spina bifida is a congenital condition in which the spinal cord protrudes through a cleft in the spinal column, resulting in paralysis. The girl, 13, is one of three children in the farm worker's home. He and his wife are the primary caregivers for their daughter, Foss said. We had detailed information from her teacher, her physical therapist, and her pediatrician, and it's really very intensive. It really takes two adults to care for her. Eisen declined to comment directly on the judge's decision, the details of which will be worked out on Monday. My heart goes out to Mr. Villalobos' family, he said, wherever they may be. But his daughter was disabled before he chose to take her handicapped van out on a social day when he left at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and had the car until he killed Pascal Bramasco, which was that evening. During Villalobos' trial, Stevens ruled that his offense was ordinary negligence, not gross negligence, Eisen said, but there's still a mandatory 5-year state prison enhancement for leaving the scene of a collision. Judge Stevens has ruled that gives him the latitude still to put the person on probation. I'm not certain as to whether or not probation is possible, Eisen said. As I argued in court, I do not believe probation is warranted, and neither did the probation department, which recommended 3 years in prison in its pre-sentence investigation. The hearing resumes Monday morning. And for those who want to go to it, it'll probably resume, I would guess, at about probably at about 8:30, and it'll probably be in Stevens Court is probably 4, 5, or 6. But you can certainly find out just by showing up in court and asking the calendar. The name of the case, again, is the defendant's name is Villalobos, and the homeless man who was hit is Bramasco, Pascal Bramasco. Your comments, Ray?
Well, first of all, I don't think I heard you say that this is his second DUI offense. His second time he's been busted for drinking and driving.
No, it's not in the story. Is that true?
Yeah, I got that out of the Sentinel. And also, who is his lawyer? Because this is one connected guy. And also, when I look at the story, the overview of the story, and I read between the lines, what I see is they're sending, you know, they're basically telling you that if you're homeless, if you're not, you know, if you're not part of the machine, I mean, come on, the farm worker, at least he's farm working. But if you're a homeless person, that your life doesn't mean anything. And I think that they probably want all homeless people to realize that, hey, in Santa Cruz County, if you're homeless, you get run over or whatever happens to you, you know, tough shit for you. It's a travesty of justice.
Well, you know, in a way, that certainly can be read as the subtext. I'm going to I'm reviewing now the Sentinel story, which I think was on Wednesday. Folks who want to read the story online for the Mercury News should go to Friday's Mercury News. And I'm seeing here we go, no jail for DUI fatality on Harlan Slough Road. A drunken driver will get probation, this is according to Kathy Redfern, for killing a homeless man as he pushed a shopping cart across Harkin Slough Road in Watsonville, or is it Slough, a judge ruled Thursday. Judge Samuel Stevens said he would sentence Arturo Reyes Villalobos to probation because he helped care for his disabled daughter. He had faced 10 years in prison after Stevens found him guilty April 22nd of vehicular manslaughter and hit and run. He hit Bramasco 7:30 p.m. November 26. Villalobos told police he looked briefly to avoid car headlights before striking Bramasco. His driver's license has been suspended. Sentencing hearings often involve emotional testimony by victims' loved ones, but no one was in court for Bramasco. Officials have been unable to find any relatives. Prosecutor Gordon Eisen said he knew little about Bramasco other than he often stayed in Ramsey Park, but he said his social standing should not result in a light sentence for his killer. He has no one to speak for but myself, Eisen said. Villalobos had a blood alcohol level more than twice the legal limit 2 hours after the crash, Eisen said, and has persisted in the falsehood that he only had 2 beers. He was convicted of drunken driving in 1989. Also, he said Villalobos did not stop after he hit the man despite looking in his rearview mirror and seeing the victim was still moving. His behavior is callous and worthy of the most extreme sanctions the court can dole out, Eisen said. Villalobos said he went to his nearby home to use the phone, but that his son was online. He called 911 after about 10 minutes and then returned to the scene and told police what happened. Deputy Public Defender Robin Foss requested electronic monitoring, said her client is attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Mr. Villalobos is not a candidate for state prison, Foss said. He and his wife have 3 children, including a daughter with spina bifida. When asked if he wished to comment, Villalobos said he would remain on probation for any length of time, pay a fine, or attend a program, but he wanted to be able to work. Please don't put me in jail, he said. Stevens said the victim's status made no difference whatsoever. He was impressed by a letter of support from a doctor who cares for Villalobos' daughter. She needs to be taken care of, the letter said. Eisen said if prison prevented Villalobos from helping care for his children, that was a very unfortunate situation, but one that shouldn't prevent him from getting a just sentence and one that would show respect for the victim. Bramasco died almost instantly after suffering massive blood loss, Stevens said.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, you have everything there in this story. And I'm wondering, you know, since when has family obligations been a get-out-of-jail-for-free card? You know, and also, this guy, you know, he's obviously callous. He left the scene. He lied about it, you know, about how many beers he had. And, you know, as an anarchist, I don't believe in rules. I don't believe in government. And the reason I don't believe in government is because I see more and more of this shit. You know, the law only works for the law's best interests. And the best interest of this case I can see is sending a message to homeless people that your life doesn't count.
Well, the deal here, I think, is also, I don't know if I would say that this guy is necessarily callous. He may have been drunk. He may have been frightened. He may have been scared and not know what to do. He did return to the scene he did call 911 eventually. Within you know, he fucked up, obviously. There's no question about it. He left the scene. But, you know, would you necessarily wait around for the police if you did a hit and run with somebody? What would be your response?
My response was, you know, good question, and I'd have to answer it honestly, and I'd have to say if nobody saw me do it, and if the guy is dead, then I'd leave.
Of course, he said he saw the guy still moving, so that sounds like he either is callous, as you suggest, or I think more likely, and perhaps it's simply my own tendency to give people the benefit of the doubt, he was scared. He wanted to get the hell away from there. He thought maybe nobody saw him and he would leave. But
the homeless guy is dead.
The homeless man, Bramasco, is gone, just like, 45 to 50 other homeless people who died last year around circumstances that I think are, you know, not necessarily due to drunk drivers or homicides, but conditions that create and are sustained by and supported by the police and by the Santa Cruz City Council. Such things as the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban criminalizes people to sleep, makes them sleep in unsafe places, and I think led to the death, for example, of Jimmy last November when he froze to death in a field. Though some say it wasn't entirely a matter of freezing and so forth, and that will be debated, no doubt. But then the question arises: do you want someone? Is jail a good alternative? Do you think this guy should go to jail, or are you just saying that this illustrates the disparity?
This illustrates the disparity. You know, I really don't think that we need jail. Period. You know, what I think we need is complete reform in Western culture. I think we need to rethink what it is that we do when we have kids, we raise them under the constructs of this culture, and we use them to fuel a machine that is not in our best interest. The human experience that I see in Western culture is, you know, it's an abomination of the way a species should treat itself, you know. I mean, we all are one, you know, regardless of what we may think about that. And Western culture has done such a fine job of, you know, fractioning everybody off, us against them, you know, shirts against skins, the Niners against the Raiders, you know. And then, of course, you know, you have governments do the same thing with wars. They do the same thing in society, and thus we have prisons. And anywhere I look, prisons don't work. Prisons just create, you know, brutal people that come out, and they're either totally messed up in their head, well, they're always messed up in their head, but either they go completely violent or they become withdrawn. It just doesn't work. I mean, it's kind of like school. I don't think that works either. We need to rethink these things, and until we can talk about these issues in a real platform, you know, have other people, you know, troubleshoot this, we don't get anywhere, because all we have is George Bush or Kerry. George Bush or Kerry. This does not help us. It does not help the United States. It does not help the planet.
What about Scott Kennedy? We have our local mayor and Mike Rodkin.
Exactly.
You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, here in beautiful Santa Cruz. I'm in the studio with Ray. My name's Robert. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. The idea, civil rights for the poor, would be a wonderful idea, as Gandhi said about Western civilization. So call in if you'd like, 427-3772, and I will actually try to pick up your call. In the meantime, let's take a brief musical break and hear something from the rather, sometimes shallow, but sometimes cute, Capital Steps.
Oh, one other thing, Robert, I got to go, but before I go, I want to say this. You know, I mean, I really think that Free Radio does a fine service to the community, and, you know, and I turn it on to as many people as I possibly can, and there's so many people out there who can't even listen to talk radio because they're so mind-controlled, it's too much for them. You know, but there are a lot of people who do, and the freakradio.org is a great thing. I mean, I tell my parents, you know, I tell every straight person that I know, you need to mark this on your computer if you have a computer, and you need to check it from time to time, because there's so much information that comes out over these airwaves and across the net that you're not going to find anywhere else. And I've traveled all over the country, I've traveled all around the planet, and, you know, this is really a unique happening, and it's right here in Santa Cruz, and I think that everybody should support the station and be part of it.
Hey, thank you, Ray.
All right, thank you.
There's a rumor around, lab technicians have found, that they don't want to torture a rat. they will use in their labs for their jabs and their stabs. More despicable subjects than that. Who can blacken your eye, kiss your money goodbye? That's a lawyer. When you see your ex-wife with a low form of life, that's a lawyer. Filing pleas, legal beagle-ease, putting on the squeeze, piling up the fees like no other. He'll aver Latin in a blur, ipso loquitur, that provocateur sued his mother. Whose diploma is through some place called Cheatham U, that's a lawyer. Next to whom will you find that your pit bull is kind, that's a lawyer. Cases bring money on a string, ching-a-ling-a-ling, got you in a sling, he's a schemer. Off to court, hit you with a tort, then he will cavort, off to a resort in his beamer. Oh, descended from worms and evolved into firms, that's a lawyer. The wings of a vulture to speed up his ambulance chase. Though he spends lots of loot on his camel hair suit, I assure ya, nothing looks quite as good as a Doberman would.
And that's Capital Steps, 76 Bad Loans, from the olden days, 1991. Well, let's return to San Francisco and hear a few more interviews from the biotech protests. What's interesting to me, of course, was how the police were controlling the area and how people were reacting. And I also ran into a couple of folks who were, one person who was selling Street Sheet, which is like Street Spirit, another homeless newspaper, which you can buy for a buck, or however much you want to spend, and I interviewed that guy. So let's hear a little of that.
My name's Seth. It's yours.
Greg there.
Great. Yeah. Appreciate you stopping and talking.
Before you go, can you say something to Free Radio? Where I'm from Santa Cruz. I'm just wondering, you're a delegate here?
Yeah, I used to live in Santa Cruz. No, I'm not a delegate. I'm just a participant. I have a company.
And your company is?
The vaccine company. We do vaccines to treat people with cancer.
And you've been here for the last 3 or 4 days?
That's right.
How's it been going? Has it been much? You've been having a dialogue here with the alien, so to speak, a protester with a sign that says GMO works for me, and he looks kind of genetically modified there.
I got a little cancer.
He's got a good guy. He's got good points. You know, I've been thinking about those issues for a very long time. I've worked on them internationally. And I think a lot of people that are attending this conference are very sensitive to those issues. And in fact, in a lot of the plenary sessions, the president of the organization and some other things have been very positive about some of the issues that are being brought up here on the street. So I think people are responsive.
Now, is this the first conversation you've had with a protester, or you've been talking to them throughout the weekend?
I've talked to them on and off throughout the weekend.
And Mr. Alien, what about you? Have you been talking to people from the conference as well?
Yes, actually, I've gotten a very positive response, anti-GMO crops, from people in Europe.
Is that likely to be...
Right.
Are any decisions being made in this conference that actually would reflect that perspective, or would you say that there's more of a pro-GMO?
No, I think like every other spectrum, there are people that are pro and people that are con, and for a lot of different reasons. And I think this just represents kind of a cross-section of people on the street. There are some commercial interests here, but people are aware that, you know, how these things can affect our environment, so they're very thoughtful about them.
The main purpose of this is this a commercial conference? Is it a scientific sharing of information? Are you guys sort of selling your products? What's the deal?
No, it's all of that, I guess. It's partially commercial because a lot of commercial interests are representative, but there's a big scientific contingent. There are people here from all over the world that are involved in various phases of this industry, all the way from the the academic stage to discovery stage to productization and stuff.
And you yourself are a local man, or you're from out of town?
That's right, I'm local.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Any reactions to the protests themselves generally? I mean, you've had some productive dialogue, you say. What about the more, I heard reports earlier that there was some violence police used against the stoppage, the traffic stoppage by protesters. Did you see any of this?
I didn't see any of that stuff. I saw people out here protesting today, and I think it's great that they're out here thinking about these issues. I think it's very positive.
And again, your name is?
Dan Thayer.
And you are with?
Backsound Company.
Thanks. Anything you want to say?
Okay, great.
Alrighty. Appreciate the help, Dan.
Yeah, good to see you.
So, a skateboarder was just stopped from going across here. Apparently, only those with badges are allowed to use the public sidewalk on Howard Street between 3rd and 4th. Since we don't have badges, we're probably going to be stopped. Should we go? You want to video my being stopped?
Sure.
All right, I'll attempt to walk at him, approaching this situation here. Right. Hi, what's the story? Are people in public
street
not...
Street is closed.
Yeah, street is closed, and that's... Normally, this is public sidewalk, so what's the...
Oh, yes, it is. But the police closed the street, so you have to go through Mission or Folsom.
And you're Mr. DeCour with the local security force?
Yes, sir.
Has it been pretty quiet here today? I'm with Free Radio in Santa Cruz.
Early in the morning, there was some noise, but things were quiet.
Protests have kind of died down?
Yeah, there you go. They go, come back. But nothing big.
And are you yourself local from out of town?
No, I live here. Yeah.
Well, that's good. But I...